and it's people like Fagan and Redfield. Later, I worked with Herskovitz to prepare me for this trip to the West Indies.
Then how did anthropology lead you to dance?
Well, it was the other way around, I guess. I'd been dancing since I was a child. I loved it. I hadn't studied very much, but I did. I had already started a school here in Chicago before I was really intently interested in anthropology. And I taught first in a studio. We called the theater that we had there the Cube Theater. I don't know if you know of it or not, but it was on Harper near the university. And I think it must have been one of a row of stables that had been converted into artist studios and so forth. But it was a wonderful atmosphere. And I had a studio there with the help of Ruth Page and Mark Turbyfill. And they were invaluable in helping me run the studio. And I studied further ballet with Mark Turbyfill. And there I started, I think, the first idea of having a company of my own came from that. And then we transferred later and moved into the we'd rent space in somebody's studio in the Fine Arts Building or the auditorium. So being in the auditorium is very familiar to me.
Mm-hmm. What was your studio there called?
Well, it was somebody else's studio. I think one was, we worked in Bernice Holmes' studio some of the time, and Vera Mirova and Ludmila Speranzeva had a studio in the Fine Arts Building. Just we'd rent space in somebody's studio to have our classes. Mm-hmm. I think so. I had not stopped dancing. I had some dancing in Joliet, Illinois, where I went to school. But I think they worked concurrently, really. Mm-hmm. I knew I couldn't stop dancing. I wouldn't give it up. I wouldn't give up the idea of training other people to dance. And the company just came out of that, and the anthropology went on at the university whenever I could make classes, because I was working in the library too here in Chicago at the time.
At what point did you meld the two, and how exactly did anthropology become kind of an inspiration research tool for your dance?
I think that when in anthropology I saw...
I'm sorry, maybe we should just wait. Okay.
When I really got into anthropology and saw that it covered just about every facet of man's life, I couldn't find anything in reference, anything useful in reference on dance. And the dance being so important in the lives of everybody, I thought that as a dancer, I would try to bring these two things together, dance and anthropology. And I looked on dance as a social trait, which it is. And so when I went to the West Indies, it was with an idea of learning their dances. And then, as an anthropologist, why were they dancing, describing the dances, describing my participation in them and what it meant, and their organization and so forth. And it turned out that dance is extremely important in anyone trying to know a people. I found that I couldn't, in Haiti, for instance, I couldn't learn anything about the dances of the people who had won their freedom from slavery there. They were African tribes. I couldn't learn anything about them without going to their rituals and ceremonies, which were vodun, or voodoo, as it's called in this country. So that led me into farther and farther into the lives of the people. I spent most of my time living in a community with them, learning the dances, but always thinking as an anthropologist.
And then at some point, you took what you learned there back into thinking as a dancer? And
yes, I did. I've written a couple of books on my field experience there in the West Indies. I went to Haiti, Jamaica, Martinique, and Trinidad. And in these places, I learned from living among the people in these places, I learned what tribes had been imported from Africa and which tribes were more likely to be found in the English colonies, for instance, the Coromanti in Jamaica, up in the hills of Jamaica. I don't remember running into the Coromanti any place else, even in South America there may be. But at the time, I thought of the Coromanti as being English, as being something that the English colonists, people that they would like to have as slaves, even though they were difficult to get along with, and the Igbo committed suicide easily. So I don't think you find too many Igbo. You find some in Haiti, vestiges of Igbo. And then there were the Arata Dahomey people, which are found mostly, their culture is mostly in Haiti. The Congo, Haiti, and Cuba, many people. And Nigerians and Senegalese and some East Coast tribes were brought to the West Indies, but not many, because there was that trip across Africa, you know, which made it hardly worthwhile. But a few Madagascar people from Madagascar, they were called Malagasy. And I know in New Orleans in America, they had these slaves from the East Coast. But chiefly in the West Indies and South America were found West Coast African tribes. And I got to know the drum rhythms that these particular tribes had brought with them, and the dances, and their whole ritual. There would be certain differences, but the ritual was what was important to the slaves and what they continued to practice and keep track of during their slavery in the colonies.
What elements of those rhythms and dances did you bring into your work for the United States, your dance here?
Well, I think that getting back to anthropology, I thought I would make my major interest form and function, the relationship between form and function. And in this way, I would take a war dance feeling from the Coromantis in the Maroon country of Jamaica, and I concluded that if you wanted to arouse aggression or anger and that sort of thing, that what was used in preparing for war would serve its function in that way. So if I wanted to show aggressiveness on the stage, I would then try to use the rhythms and the patterns that had been used by these people for preparing for war or arousing aggression.
Is there an example of the music that we talked about? I haven't heard them yet, so I don't know if that fits into these examples, or maybe you could explain how one of these is directly influenced by what you heard there.
Well, I think one of our numbers that encompasses the movements and the rhythms of almost the entire Caribbean is Shango. It's the closing number at the our performances at the Auditorium Theater, and I think the material from it was gathered by me from part of it Cuba, part of it Trinidad, part of it Haiti. It is sacrifice of a white cock, and this is purely, it's West African, and it's known all through the Caribbean and South America. And in preparing it for theater, though, that's another thing. You can't just show something authentic and go through a whole ceremony as a program number. So I had to create, it's a true story of a boy being possessed by a snake, and that is very frequent in all through any island that's related in any way to Nigeria or to the Lukumi cults. The Django that we're showing is a ritual taking place in the woods at night, and there are the people, usually the Mambos, who are very high priestesses, and
had a stage like that.
Where was I? Could you back up a little bit?
Sure.
It comes down when you're using authentic material for something other than what it's meant for among the people, you have to decide this thing again of form and function. I wanted to show a ritual, and I knew that I couldn't show it exactly as it was, so I tried to get it as nearly as possible what I had seen someplace or another. And I had actually seen a boy possessed of the serpent god Dambala, who incidentally is my husband, in quotes, in Haiti, in my initiations in Haiti. This boy was possessed, and that means that he was mounted or being taken over by Dambala, who is his visual representation is a serpent, and this is directly from Dahomey. It's still, Dam actually means serpent in Dahomey. So the boy that I had seen in the middle of a ceremony, and when he was taken over by the god, climbed a tree, but he made his way up remarkably like one of the huge boa constrictors that you find in Haiti. Not huge, I mean 8 or 10 foot long. And he made his way up into the tree and then stopped everyone, you know, just as the boy does in our Shango on stage. He crossed his hands in the air and stopped everyone, and then they began to sing, and the priest began to take him out of his possession. So he fell, still in a trance, but he actually fell to the ground beneath where people were waiting for him. And he stayed in that trance I don't know how long, because they carried him off, you know, which when somebody's really overcome, there are people or attendants or hunsi, they're called in Haiti, followers who will take care of you and see that you don't injure yourself. So that much I did almost identically as I had seen it. Then I put in the songs that I particularly liked from Cuba, and we actually recorded one of those songs, which is called Toitica La Negra, and it's a woman who is has been rather ill-used by the gods, and she's saying that you know, I'm down, I'm completely overcome, and who is going to help me? It's that sort of thing. Well, that's in our ceremony, and then we have the kind of frenzy that happens when people have when they're closing one possession. So I use there a Haitian theme, one of their gods called Nago, and then the boy is brought in on a large drum. He's still in a trance, and he's brought in drumming. He's brought in by the men, carried in. Now this was about all that this is a number that must run about 12 minutes, something like that, which is long for a theater, for just an incidental number. And I think that encompassed in it, though, is about all I could get of the ritual. Now, that is that particular kind of ritual. I could have gone and used one of the other gods, that one of the negative gods, for instance, or these gods that build aggression and so forth, but that would have had to be another occasion.
So what happened when you began to put these rituals on stage in dance form? When audiences here first started to see them, what kind of a reaction did you get? It would be quite unusual compared to what was being shown then.
Yes, well, I'm rather amused and interested and actually pleased to see something done like a film. I don't know if you heard of it, The Serpent and the Rainbow. It's all the rage now. And it interests me because that sort of thing we were doing on stage, I mean, we didn't go into any profound research on how zombies are made or anything like that. I had done a little writing on it myself, but I was interested to see their little bits of ritual and ceremony. I haven't seen the film, but I have seen a few little cuts from it. And, of course, it's purely Haitian. I think it's very well done. And I'm interested to note that here, how many years later, maybe 30 or 40 years later, that we did that sort of thing on stage. And people loved it. They didn't know what they were seeing then. I think by now, through television and press and radio, they have an inkling of what they're seeing.
Were they taken aback by it at first, or did it take any time, do you think, for the audience to adjust to that as dance?
I don't know what they thought, really. I think that they were entranced, and I think sometimes at the end of Shango always closed our first act. At the end of the first act, I think sometimes for a few minutes they were stunned. You know, it is a very overwhelming number, and the applause wouldn't begin until I realized it was over. It was sort of like looking at a television for people, and they expected it to go on forever. So most people loved it but didn't know why, and I think it wasn't until we began to be criticized, have critics in Europe, that there came to be a real understanding of what we were doing, because London and Paris, for instance, had seen so many Africans go through with their dance and their rhythms and so forth, that they were a little more prepared to see what we were doing. But we were in London first in 1948, and that's not so long after the war. And London, you could still see that there had been a war. And the people, you could see it. And they were just absolutely taken by our show, by the color of it and the excitement. But during this particular number, Shango, one woman fainted, I remember, on opening night. And then a little later in our stay, a woman...
Just said one woman fainted. Do you mean because of what she saw on stage?
Actually, the drums and our music was something that was just too much for people who hadn't had that kind of excitement, and they loved it. We had wonderful reception in London. It took a little while for people to really absorb it. And I remember one woman came backstage after Shango and said, "I think it's terrible that you have this white rooster killed on the stage." And I said, "But it's not alive, it's stuffed," and so forth and so on, and they just do the gesture. And she said, "I know," but she represented some sort of an animal protection society. And she said, "I don't care if it is, if it's dead, it's there, and it's been killed, and it's wrong," and so forth. Well, I didn't do anything about it. I couldn't quite change the ritual, and I haven't changed it, but I know her, I understand her point.
What does Shango mean, a direct translation? Is there one?
Shango is the name of a god. He was the god of thunder and lightning in most places, and he's very powerful. He was one of the very powerful gods, very high up in hierarchy. Although Dambala, I think, in Haiti is higher than Shango. But Shango is very, very, I wouldn't say bloodthirsty, but a very violent god. And if you see the Shango on our stage, I think you do get that feeling.
Okay. And I guess I want to jump ahead to what's going on stage now. There's been a sort of gap in performances of your material, I think. This is sort of being billed as something of a revival of your work. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
I think that there is a gap because we, as a company, stopped performing in 1963, I guess it was, and it's not, there have been other companies that do have tried to do our work, but I think without having it carefully prepared with the people, and people who we had to teach For instance, in New York, the Ailey Company, we had to teach them the as much as we could have done them technique. And I think this is why, that people just did not have the technique or the companies that would do this sort of thing. And I realize now we had stayed together. There's some of our dancers who are teaching here in Chicago. Lucille Ellis and Tommy Gomez are teaching Dunham technique, and it's being taught all over the world, but you just can't do it in a hurry, and you can't get together a company and show this kind of material in a hurry, and I think that's why.
Are they still in Chicago?
Yes, they are. Okay. They're teaching here, and as a matter of fact, I think they're both going to be teaching. They're going to open a Boulevard Art Center. I'm not sure the exact name, but I'm coming back in June for that, and I think they'll both be teaching there.
Okay, maybe I can get a hold of them too. Are there some elements that you can describe for us that make up the Dunham technique?
Yes, I think that the elements are knowing how to understand the people who perform these things, like, for instance, the rituals, why they're done and where they're done, and what their ceremonies are composed of. And, you know, I got so far as how do the children, the babies come, and how do they react? I mean, this is in the field itself, and how many old people are there, and what is their reaction? I learned always to take most of my material, authentic material, from the very old, because they remembered. I was looking at it as an anthropologist, and I wanted to see the origins and how things had changed. I'm still doing that in as much as I can in Haiti. But I think that Dunham technique is, I've called it holistic. You have to think of it as something for your body and your spirit and your mind. It's all together. And if you don't approach it in this way, and approach this primitive material in percussion and rhythm and dance, if you don't approach it in that way, that you just can't perform it. You know, it becomes artificial. And I know I was never so embarrassed in my life. I was invited somewhere to see a sort of an homage to me at the end of a show was being given, and these people came out, and of course I've been always so proud of our costumes, which my husband John Pratt, who's also from Chicago, and he designed our costumes. They came out with sort of a, I don't know what impression they had of the clothes. It was nothing like ours anyway, and they danced in the same way, and I said, I can't believe it. Is that what they see in us? And I was really, really sorry about it, you know. Was that their interpretation? On the other hand, I have seen people who tried seriously to work with members of our company and learn properly, and that's what the Ailey Company is doing now. They went seriously into how to reconstruct a Dunham show, and I think it's working.
So this other company just showed a shallowness of research, a lack of depth of understanding of what they were putting on stage. Is that what was missing from their performance?
Yes, I think that was it. You see, some sorts of entertainment or theater you can go to and you can imitate, and that's fine. You can't do that with Dunham technique. You have to know it. And I don't know, I look at the television a lot, and I see little bits and pieces and vestiges of what we used to do and of our style, even in the teaching of dance, but so often it misses the point.
You've incorporated a lot of things, and I want to come back a little bit to the costumes. Explain the importance of the costumes as part of your overall show and concept.
I couldn't think of our show without its decor and costumes. When I came back from the West Indies to Chicago, was about, I think it was 1937, and I was working with the WPA in their theater and dance division. And there I met my husband, John Pratt, who was to be my husband later, and I just couldn't conceive of doing what we're doing and what we've done for all these years without having the cooperation of his cooperation, of someone who was as interested as I in the origins of things, and then in building them through your own artistic creativity into something that would make a show. And that's what the way he looked at things. I don't think he ever did just a costume, maybe some Haitian peasant things or something like that, but everything was created. Everything that he did was the real thing, but through his artistic creativity, and that's the way I like to work.
Describe, for instance, what the stage would look like in one of these songs that you're giving us here. Maybe this one from the film Mambo, maybe, or pick one that you know I have, so we can listen to it and imagine.
I know, New Love, New Wine.
Okay.
I was doing choreography for the film Mambo in Italy, Silvana Mangano, and they needed a song sort of for her, and somehow or another we were in Venice, and I don't know what was going on in my life, but I did write the song, which was used in the film, called New Love, New Wine, and it was for a nightclub scene, and Silvana sings part of it. I don't think she ever considered herself a singer, just as I don't.
You're describing the nightclub scene for this song.
Yes, it was a nightclub scene, and Silvana was the singer in the show. But I don't know, I can't say what inspired this thing of New Love, New Wine. It was not a blues, but it was very nostalgic in some way, and I liked it. So we kept that not in our theater repertoire, but in our nightclub repertoire, because frequently we had to play nightclubs and we had to play whatever just to keep the company together. And I enjoyed Las Vegas and Ciro's as much as I enjoyed the operas and places we played. But New Love, New Wine was one of our big things that opened at Ciro's. And it had our group of singers, these wonderful voices. And what could I say about it as a dance thing? It had this misty feeling of figures moving. I guess something in Venice must have given me this feeling, moving through almost fog and reacting to the lyrics, which were chiefly about the loneliness of having lost love, but at the same time finding new love, as one must try new wine now and then, something like that. I remember it was done all in tones of maroon, and I may someday reconstruct it. I like the song, though. It's only been recorded once in this country. It was recorded in England, and once in this country, and I'm sorry to say I can't remember by whom. It was a long time ago. I know, someone named Anne Hathaway, who was a singer, recorded that. But I'd like to revive it as we've done the show and revive some of our nightclub material.
Do you personally think you might just launch your last company you disbanded more or less because it's getting too difficult to keep up with the schedule, or too difficult to fill the schedule?
And too difficult to fund it, because we have never had government funding. And this was a great handicap. As we toured, and we toured in 57 countries of the world, which at that time was probably much of the world.
Do you think you might try it again? Let me just...
I don't know whether I would have the strength or actually the interest to launch another company of my own. I'm happy to work with the Ailey Group because they want to do it, they love it as we did, and they're responding beautifully. But I am interested in children, and once we have a school in East St. Louis and a museum there, and the children, I've given them one or two of our numbers from our show, our former shows, which they love doing. They're things that would be appropriate for them. I doubt very much if I would ever do my own company again, But in thinking it over, I have the idea that just as we've done this for theater, we might prepare something for nightclubs. Because we went to Las Vegas and took them by storm because they'd never seen such a thing on their stages. And we'd go back and forth, Las Vegas and Reno and Ciro's. And here in Chicago it was, I'll think of it later, someplace here on the north side that we appeared in a club. So I think companies will come out of my presence as long as I'm around to sort of guide them. Then I'd feel good about it. But I would certainly hate to see people try to do what we did without the background of knowledge that we had to have.
Do you think there's something about audiences today, the climate today, that makes a sort of, I don't want to say comeback, and you know, and all that implies, but this kind of revival, is it time for that, and why exactly?
I think it is. It's something that I felt, that I know, and one thing that I'm good at, I never call myself a dancer, really. I feel I'm a catalyst, and I also have a certain sense of prescience, a certain sense of being ahead and thinking ahead of the times. Now, I feel that, you know, this old saying of everything that goes around comes around or something, I think that if you look at anything, any human expression, theater, art, dance, whatever, clothing, that this inevitable circle is made. And I don't know just what is happening now in theater, but it's happening among the people too. I had almost the feeling in the New York opening and this opening, which are the only two I've been to in this country, the feeling that the people they were at a point where they needed this sort of combination of beauty and sound, because I think our music is very important, and content. I think that it's something people need. I don't know, because I haven't gone to dance. I very seldom go to anything and dance, just because I guess I had so much of it. But it seems to me that something must have happened to the stage in this country, that there's not the same kind of lighting and scenery and I'd say lushness that we had in our theater. And the reason for it is, I mean, you'd have to analyze why. But surely I think eventually the demands of the union concerning the theater may be relaxed a little bit and help for things like rehearsal and so forth and so on. But I think that what we're showing them in theater now is something that people need, you know. And I think that's why they come and tell their friends and come.
I know we're not going to have as much time as I want. You said you worked with Ruth Page early on.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out why it's taking so long.
It went the wrong way.
Oh, I see.
I pushed the wrong way. Nobody can get to that. Let me just stop. Yeah, that's all. Just it's moving.
Angelico, and a very lazy girl was she. She spent all her time sitting in the sun on the island of Haiti.
Can you describe a little bit of what goes on during all this?
Well, to begin with, this is a very old Haitian folk song, and I wrote the English lyrics at the beginning and at the end, and this was one of our favorite nightclub numbers. First part is sung by wonderful tenor that we had. He was a Zulu named Victor Makunu. I can't put in the clicks like he would. And then the company, I had the singers with me on stage, and I sang and, you know, just sort of flirted and did a little bit of what's known as the merengue, which is the Haitian popular dance, like you do the rumba in Cuba, for instance. And I can't remember, it seems to me as though I had a dancer was singled out to come in and dance with me. But the important thing is the lyrics, that we didn't translate all the lyrics, I'm sorry, on stage in the nightclub. But it's about a song about a little girl in Haiti who was very lazy, and she liked to just lie around in the sun and not do anything. And the song says, Angelico, if you go on doing that, you'll stay home and you won't you won't get any lover or any marriage or anything. And the song is Angelico in Creole, Chita Kai Mama. It says, Angelico, just go sit in your mother's house. And it's almost as though her friends and her husband are telling her, you don't know how to cook, and you don't know how to wash clothes, and you don't know how to make bonbon, so you're just going to end up sitting at home.
So what happens on stage?
On stage, it's hard for me to describe, because I guess I must have improvised much of the time. It was a thing of dancing the merengue, and the singers, I think, stayed pretty near their microphone over on one side of the stage, and sang their responses, as you can hear in the number itself, while one of the dancers and I did the merengue, which is sort of like the rumba, as I said. And from time to time, I would come back and sing in, as you can hear, sing with them. It was a very light number, and very charming, and very Haitian.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, you were saying, I just turned that down so I'll be able to record it myself and get a clearer version that we'll listen to along with your words when I air this. You were saying about bringing this back to stage, you think there's a real need for this now. And yet there's so, it still is foreign to modern stage, isn't it?
Of course it is. You know, there are two generations, I believe, that have not seen us in the theater. And I'm astonished, you know. I think I will have a picture done in Hollywood before long on my life. And my agent called me from Hollywood to say, you know, they want it, they'd love to do it, they like the synopsis and outline, but they say, who is Catherine Dunham? And he was outraged, you know, he said. But I can understand it. I think we appeared last in this country. I think we made a cross-country tour with a show called Bamboche, which closed in 1962. I think maybe the Cuban invasion had a lot to do with it. People were all at home listening to what was going on, and they didn't come to the theater so much. If we'd been able to stay that week in New York, I think we would have made our usual tour. We'd come in from California. But what's happened, I believe, is that a whole new approach to living and thinking is taking over probably the whole world, and certainly this country. And there's some sort of a feeling that, I don't know, that you should give people something highly intellectual and something, this sort of lack, I feel, of decor on the stage and lack of using the full range of human emotions as we do in our show. I think there's been a reticence to do that. People intellectualize, I think, so many things instead of having that affective feeling about things, having a feeling of warmth and love and gaiety and sadness, and like we did in our show. I haven't really analyzed it, but I know there is a change. That change has taken place, and that people are rather, they're beginning to feel nostalgia about a time when things were probably less worrisome, and you could look at television and not have to see the tragedies of the world one after another happening.
Do Do you think you'll have to modify your work somehow? Is it such a strong nostalgia that you can bring this kind of thing right back to the stage sounding so 40s? Or do you envision some changes, and if so, what?
No, I don't think I'll make any changes. I don't think I could. I wouldn't want to, and I don't think I need to. I think, truthfully, that that people want it, and that's why they come. I believe they've had sold-out houses whenever they appeared. I know we certainly did in New York and here in Chicago, but the gala has only been done. This Magic of Catherine Dunham has been done very little in this country. They did some in Europe and intend to go back to Europe, and I will join them in September in Paris. I'm curious to see what the Paris reaction will be, because Paris is a strange city. They love you. And they stay with you, and they make sort of a thing out of you. And whether or not they will accept other people doing my material, that's something I want to find out. But I'll be there with them anyway.
That's the Ailey Company in Paris.
Yes.
Is there another United States date for this show, do you know?
Yes, it will be in Boston, I guess, soon, maybe in 10 days. Mm-hmm. And it will be at the Kennedy Center in Washington, maybe next month. I don't know the exact dates,
okay,
but yes, there are a few
dates. I wasn't sure what the schedule dance figure. When you work together, do you have maybe any anecdotes about working together in those early days in the studio on the South Side or something you can share about how she worked then, how you worked together?
I always thought of Ruth Page as being, in such an enviable position. We were sort of scrounging around just for carfare to get to these various studios, and she always seemed to be affluent and in good health, and I was sure her knees didn't hurt like mine did in those days, and traveled all over, and she had been to Martinique and did her ballet La Giblesse before I went there, and I'm sure I was influenced by her work in that particular ballet. But, I knew her, and I think at first I was sort of a little bit in awe, and then I began to know her as a person, and my husband knew her, and found that she is essentially was and still is, the last time I saw her in Chicago, doing things. It's wonderful, her continuous creativity, her continuous taking of themes like Carmen and putting them here today, or themes like Frankie and Johnny, I think it was. I'm astonished at her originality, and I certainly hope that she keeps on at it, and I hope that she has a more than one Dauphin or Dauphine, which I'm lucky enough to have some few people that will carry on when I'm not here. But I enjoyed working with Ruth Page, and she has been, whether I'd see her in Paris or here over the years, a steadfast friend. And that has helped.
I've interviewed her recently as well. Of all these, and you did so many different things, music, choreography, film, all these. Is there one thing that you would say that's a really famous?
You in my life?
Yeah.
Oh, I would like to go on writing. I've done a good deal of writing. And my new book, which is called The Minefield, begins in Chicago when I came back from the West Indies. And I think it'll be my best book. It's quite fine the way it's going. So that's what I'd like to do. You know, I can't look forward to the next 40 years, I think, of doing this, that, and the other. So since there is a question of a limitation of time and energy and so forth and so on, I feel that I will end up carrying out my project of finishing the years when I came back from the West Indies and until we went to Europe. I have put Europe in the hands of other people. I think that's not too hard to follow the press. And it was, I guess, a highlight of my life, that long touring period. But I think that to know me and for me to get out of my system the things that happened to me for the 10 years after I came back from the West Indies until we went to Europe, I think it's very important. Mm-hmm. Covers Mexico and Canada, and Hollywood, and everything. I began to understand this feeling of being the first, you know, first color short then the first dance short and color short at Warner's, and then, you know, various things that we did, opening certain theaters and sort of doing away with the segregation in theaters and in the eating places and hotels. It was a lot of pioneering work, but it was a minefield.
Is there one of those things that you can point to that you're most proud of or to her?
Well, I'm very pleased with the fact that when I would fight something like a segregation in a hotel or something like that, such as I found in Cincinnati, for instance. We were appearing in Lexington, Kentucky, and actually the cooks and waiters went on strike because I was living with my secretary across the river in Cincinnati in one of their top white hotels. And I say white because they didn't let black people or colored people live there in those days. And I wouldn't move. I was booked into it, and I stayed. And I think it was wonderful to know that I had known Harry Bridges and was able to phone him. You know who he is, of course. You don't? Oh, my goodness. Well, you must. He's an Australian who came to this country and stayed mostly in San Francisco organizing the Longshoremen's Union. And at the drop of a hat, he could stop all the boats loading and unloading here from here around the world. He was a very, very powerful, wonderful person. So I called him in this my trials in this particular case of discrimination, and he immediately called. And of course, those those people were back through their unions, were back at work in 10 minutes. He didn't allow that. So these are things that, as I write the book, I'm remembering so much that otherwise I wouldn't remember without writing it.
When was that incident? Place
must have been, it was during the Yurok tour, and it must have been 1942, probably 42 or 3.
Mm-hmm. To some of these earlier shows, what kind of a reaction did you get when you put on stage what must have been quite unusual for the time?
All right, we had varied reactions, most of them favorable. Just, I remember when we went to Boston with the Rites de Passage, or Rites of Passage. This was a number that Miss Dunham did that caused quite a bit of controversy because of the pelvic movements. And very often, or I think Martha Graham at one time referred to Miss Dunham as the high priestess of the pelvic area or region, I've forgotten, or the high priestess of the pelvis, something like that. But, of course, that was just one facet of Miss Dunham's choreography and her anthropological approach to the her research that she had done earlier in the West Indies and in the Caribbean when she received a Rosenwald Fellowship at the University of Chicago to complete her thesis. And, so we had many, many kinds of reactions, but all favorable, exciting, and favorable. Are you gonna-